morning. I'm Mark Riley here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and you're listening to Morning Sedition.
How about that?
I got no screen, got no board, so I figured I'd do a little scream. Good morning! It is 6 minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron has a well-deserved day off this day before Thanksgiving. Apparently, he's going down to Florida to cook for, like, multitudes. You know, he's going to turn fish into bread and fish into a thousand fishes, whatever that biblical parable is. He's going down to his mom's house, so we wish him a happy Thanksgiving. Special good morning to all truckers. Please keep safe today. I was on my way into work and saw what they call in the traffic game, a fully inflamed and engulfed tractor trailer on one of the off ramps of the George Washington Bridge here in the New York area. I mean, it's nothing quite as scary as seeing a gigantic machine, you know, with a fire coming out of virtually every part of the machine. And it was one of those situations where they were closing off entrances and exits. I hope it's okay by now. That was a couple of hours ago. So please, truckers, be careful. Good morning to those who leave work early to get a head start on Thanksgiving. Those that, and you know who you are. Some of you are going to be in. It's only going to be a half day for you. A special good morning to those who will have to stay late to cover for those who leave early. Good morning to those who will feed the homeless and hungry on Thanksgiving Day tomorrow. Good morning to everyone involved in producing dairy products and organic produce. Why those two? I don't know. It just came to mind. And a special good morning to everyone who communicates through whatever means with Air America Radio. Our top stories this morning, dirty bomber Jose Padilla has been indicted, but not, I repeat, not for being a dirty bomber. We're going to tell you why the Bush administration brought those charges. Tom DeLay, you may remember him, former majority leader of the House. He may have a tough time retaking that gig. Why the judge in his case made things tougher for the hammer coming up. And yeah, we told you a while ago, Marin and I, that there were troop reductions coming in Iraq and that troop reductions would be on the lips of some prominent Republicans. We'll tell you who's on board. Congressman John Murtha's stand-down bus. Now, of course, just the other day, you had Bush and Dick Cheney and the rest of these people essentially saying that anyone who talked about a troop reduction in Iraq, anyone who talked about a timetable for getting U.S. troops out of Iraq was some sort of unpatriotic traitor, someone that should be, you know, I guess, put in front of a wall and shot. Metaphorically, you understand, because I know the Bush administration really isn't into violence too much. But now we're hearing it from some very unlikely places, very, very unlikely places. Speaking of unlikely, let's talk for a moment about Jose Padilla. Some of you may not remember Jose Padilla. He was one of those people that was swept up very, very early in the wake of September 11th. He was, according to the charges that were being thrown around at the time, thrown around, I want to emphasize, not brought anywhere, but thrown around. At that time, he was accused of being a dirty bomber. On May 8, 2002, Jose Padilla arrived at Chicago's O'Hare Airport carrying just over $10,000. Names and phone numbers of his training camp recruiter and sponsor, that's a Al-Qaeda training camp recruiter and sponsor, according to the government, and email addresses of other Al-Qaeda operatives. He was arrested on a material witness warrant. That is May 8th, 2002. The guy's been in the can ever since. Now, it might come as a surprise to you that the day before Thanksgiving, or 2 days before Thanksgiving, because this actually happened yesterday, they decided to charge Jose Padilla. Now, why do you think that happened? You think it was just like the Bush administration suddenly realized that the people who said he should get a federal trial, he should have a chance to confront his accusers like most Americans, you think they suddenly thought that was right for him? Does somebody seriously believe that this government said, well, you know, all of those arguments, all those people who've been telling us that we need to treat Jose Padilla differently, we don't need to lock him in a cell someplace in South Carolina and leave him there and literally throw away the key. Let's try something different. You think that's the reason why? Well, you'd be wrong. The Justice Department, under Brendan McDonald's favorite guy, Alberto Gonzalez, was facing a Monday deadline to get the Supreme Court to talk them out of reviewing Padilla's 3-year detention, because Padilla actually did end up having a lawyer who has filed any number of briefs trying to get the man out of the current situation he's in. He is currently, or was currently until yesterday, classified as an enemy combatant, which under the Bush administration doctrine meant that he could be locked up forever, it seems, without charge, without having come to trial, without being able to confront his accuser or even refute the charges against him. Now, let's be really, really clear about a couple things, all right? Because a lot of times when people talk about this, the first thing that happens to the, quote, liberals or the left is that, you know, we're accused of mollycoddling, you know, terrorists and criminals, et cetera, et cetera. Jose Padilla may, in fact, be a bad guy. All right, let's start there. This guy, by the way, let's start in 1998. He flew from Florida to Egypt. Now, there's nothing illegal about that. You know, as an American citizen, you got the right to fly to Egypt. He signed, allegedly, in July of 2000, a Mujahideen data form in preparation for violent jihad training in Afghanistan. Is that like an application? Is that something you fill out? List your level of commitment to the cause here. Why do you hate the Americans? Why do you want to destroy Israel? What is a Mujahideen data form, for God's sake? But apparently he filled one out, if you believe our Justice Department. In September and October of that same year, he allegedly attended an Al-Qaeda-affiliated Al-Farouq training camp in Afghanistan under the name Abdullah al-Espani. Now, it's important to know, too, that Jose Padilla did, in fact, convert to Islam. I don't know if that's his Islamic name or just an alias. Who knows? 2002, as we mentioned, early in 2002, he met with an unidentified accomplice. They approached Al-Qaeda leaders in Afghanistan about committing terrorist acts in the U.S. He was given $15,000 to carry out that attack, and I guess he only spent $5,000 of it between early in the year and May 8th, because he came into the country with about $10,000. Now, these are all allegations against Jose Padilla. In December of 2002, U.S. District Judge Michael Mukasey ruled that the federal court has authority to decide whether Padilla was properly detained as an enemy combatant. Then his court case has kind of gone through the ringer. In December of 2003, the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit ordered Padilla to be released from military custody within 30 days, and if the government chose, tried in civilian courts. The appeals court agreed to suspend its ruling in January of 2004 after the Bush administration appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. But you know what? The Bush administration doesn't really want the Supreme Court to rule on Jose Padilla's case. And let's talk for a moment, if we could, about why. When he was arrested, when he was taken into custody, Jose Padilla was a, quote, dirty bomber in training. He was planning to blow up apartment buildings in the United States. He represented a grave U.S. national security threat that, at that time, could not be handled by the courts. Now let's fast forward to yesterday. Jose Padilla has been charged with conspiracy to murder, maim, and kidnap people, not in U.S. apartment buildings, but outside the United States. And in contrast to when he was first busted, when he was a national security threat that could not be handled by the courts, now he can, in fact, be tried by the federal courts. Alberto Gonzalez, the attorney general, refused to try and reconcile for people the charges against Jose Padilla when he got busted and the charges against Jose Padilla yesterday. He would only speak to the charges against Jose Padilla that are pending and that he will be actually charged with and tried on. Now, there are two very telling points about this. One, of course, is Gonzalez not talking about the dirty bomber issue. And this is the real catch to all this. Do you know that they can actually reclassify this guy as an enemy combatant, I guess, at any time they choose, and then put him back into the same detention and hell or detained hell that he's been held for the last 3 years? Now, again, Jose Padilla could be a really, really bad guy. Jose Padilla, in the largest sense, is not the issue. The issue is, to what extent can an administration extend its presidential powers to detain a United States citizen indefinitely, as long as they feel like it, without trial and basically without charge other than what they release to the media? That's the issue with Jose Padilla, and that's why, no matter what he did, he was entitled from day one to a trial by a jury in a court. And I don't know what the government's so scared of. They just convicted another guy of plotting to assassinate Bush. He faces life in prison when he says his name is Abu Ali, and he went before a jury in Virginia and was tried and convicted and now faces life in prison. So what in the world is the Bush administration so afraid of? If you put this before a jury of fair and sober-minded Americans, it would seem to me if the government had enough evidence to lock Jose Padilla up, they could try him, convict him, lock him up, throw away the key, and nobody would be upset about it. I certainly wouldn't be if he was tried by a jury of his peers, given a fair trial. There is a 3.5-year gap between Jose Padilla's detention and the possibility of a fair trial, and somebody needs to explain why, because it's not really the way America is supposed to do its business. We're going to come back in a moment. We're going to talk to you a little bit about Louisiana, because it's not recovering exactly the way people have been telling us it is, or even as we had hoped it would be. Tom DeLay faces a delay, and a serious delay. And we're going to get into the issue of troop reductions in Iraq, because it's not exactly what Dick Cheney says it is. It's 17 minutes past the hour. I'm Mark Reilly, flying solo on Morning Sedition, Air America Radio.
This is Wayne Gilman, better known to the hard body mamas of the greater New York metropolitan area as News Daddy. But I'm not busting a cap in some jive cat's ass for hogging the printer when I'm on deadline. I'm having a funky good time with Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Ooh, News Daddy.
But look who's awake. Ready for another taste of Wayne?
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. It's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Reilly. I'm not filling in for Mark Maron. Mark Maron's just not here. He's got a day off. He's down in Florida. Actually, he will be back with you on Monday. I will be off that week. We'll be back together a week from next Monday. You can email us at sedition@airamericaradio.com. Coming up, we've got a filmmaker and the organizer of the 13th Annual African Diaspora Film Festival, which is taking place here in New York. We, later on this morning as well, are going to be talking to Bob Sullivan, MSNBC Tech and Consumer Affairs correspondent. We're going to talk about some of these tech issues that are coming up, including the debacle at Sony BMG, the new Xbox, and the TiVo iPod connection. And, of course, later this morning, the Goliath of Gotham. Yeah, right. I'm doing great this morning. The Goliath of Gotham, none other than Mark Green, will be joining us in studio as well. If you're just waking up, guess who says we may not need as many U.S. troops in Iraq as we have had, quote, all that much longer. Hint, it was not Russ Feingold. We'll tell you who it is. Jose Padilla, the so-called dirty bomber, is no longer an enemy combatant. Bush's Justice Department has decided to try him in a U.S. court. Why? The answer will amaze you. Tom DeLay wants to be the once and future majority leader of the House of Representatives. Not so fast, says the judge in his criminal case. Other things on a judge's plate sure can make things just a little bit complicated. That's right, folks. There are people other than Democrats, people other than radicals, people other than Michael Moore, who are now talking about a phased withdrawal of American troops out of Iraq. In fact, there are published reports that say the Pentagon itself is talking about reducing the Iraq troop commitment by 3 brigades. Now, I actually went and looked this up. A combat brigade is approximately 3,500 people. So when we start talking about 3 brigades being taken out of Iraq, we're talking about just over 10,000 troops. Now, they're talking about doing this not by the end of next year, but in fact, as early next year, January, February, March, somewhere in that general area. And they're also talking about reducing overall troop strength to something on the order of 100,000, which would be a reduction of almost 10 brigades by the end of the year. We have told you time and time again, I don't want to say we told you so, but we did. We have told you over and over again that Republicans in the Congress would not be able to run for re-election next year on a platform of maintaining the status quo in Iraq. It won't work. That dog won't hunt, as I believe a former president once said. It was just not feasible for Republicans to sit up and say, well, we're going to keep it at the same number without some kind of a definitive plan. So now they're starting to put some meat on the bones. And guess who says that they won't need so much U.S. troop strength all that much longer? It was Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State. And by the way, one of the few members of the Bush administration who has any credibility left on any subject whatsoever. You want to, well, we won't get into that because I don't like to stray from stuff because sometimes my mind doesn't work the way most people's do. But we'll get into, what some of the other people in the administration are up to momentarily because they're up to some skullduggery on their own. So now they're talking about, of course, the Republicans trying to be able to run on the proposition that we helped lower the number of troops in Iraq, even as George W. Bush and Dick Cheney smear anyone who says that it's time to start thinking about taking troops out of Iraq. Now, how does this work? How do you have, on the one hand, the Pentagon, all right, an office of government, and the Secretary of State, a cabinet-level official, saying that, maybe we won't need that many troops inside Iraq? And yet you've got the president and vice president saying something very, very different. Well, I'll leave that to your minds to sort out. I know I've sorted it out for myself. It is part of a two-track strategy, in my judgment, designed in part to confuse the American people. But at its core is a political agenda and a political objective, and that's the maintenance of Republican majorities in the House and Senate. And by the way, when we're talking, we talked earlier about Jose Padilla. Consider the fact that the Bush administration, who are they avoiding taking this case to? The very people they wanted to take it to in the first place, the United States Supreme Court. Why would they want to delay taking a case like Jose Padilla's to the U.S. Supreme Court? A, because they probably think they'd lose the way the court is currently constituted. And guess what? Bush has got a nominee on the table, Samuel Alito. It may be time now for the Democrats to start talking to Alito about what he thinks about the ability of a president or the ability of any administration to lock people up and throw away the key. Maybe that's one of those things that needs to be talked about in these confirmation hearings so that this guy doesn't get away scot-free by stonewalling on abortion and stonewalling on many of the other rulings that he has made. We're going to be coming back shortly. We're going to talk about Louisiana and about the recovery that isn't. We're going to talk about Ted Koppel's last night on the air, last night doing Nightline, and a whole lot more. Stay with us. It's 27 minutes past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
November 22nd, 2005. I'm Ted Koppel, and this is Nightline. Tonight, remembering an old friend.
34 minutes past the hour. It is Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley, and the voice you just heard was, of course, Ted Koppel, doing his final broadcast on the program Nightline, which he began 25 years ago in March of 1980 during the midst of the Iran hostage crisis. And God, 25 years have flown by that fast. I remember when Nightline first started as what was at that point seen as a temporary program. Everybody thought Nightline would end as soon as the hostages were freed. 25 years later, it ends on Ted Koppel's terms. And I got to say, I've admired this guy for a very long time. Not everything he's done, but certainly admired his ability to be unique as an anchor person. You know, he's not a particularly telegenic guy. He's not one of these guys that likes to joke and smile and that sort of thing. I guess maybe his replacements will. But Ted Koppel always gave me the impression he was a no-nonsense newsman. And he finished his broadcast on Nightline. He finished his final broadcast on Nightline, talking about one particular series of interviews that he did, which were among the most requested of the 25 years that show was on the air. That was the Tuesday with Maury. This was, of course, a guy by the name of Maury Schwartz, who was a Brandeis University professor, and he allowed Nightline to document the last year of his life as he battled Lou Gehrig's disease. He is also the subject of a book by Mitch Albom, the Detroit Free Press sports writer, called Tuesdays with Maury. Let's go to Ted Koppel on his final broadcast on Nightline.
There's this quiz I give to some of our young interns when they first arrive at Nightline. I didn't do it with the last batch. It's a little too close to home. How many of you, I'll ask, can tell me anything about Eric Severide? Blank stares. How about Howard K. Smith or Frank Reynolds? Not a twitch of recognition. Chet Huntley? Jack Chancellor? Still nothing. David Brinkley sometimes causes a hand or two to be raised, and Walter Cronkite may be glad to learn that a lot of young people still have a vague recollection that he once worked in television news. What none of these young men and women in their late teens and early 20s appreciates, until I point it out to them, is that they have just heard the names of seven anchormen or commentators who were once so famous that everyone in the country knew their names. Everybody. Trust me, the transition from one anchor to another is not that big a deal. Cronkite begat Rather, Chancellor begat Brokaw, Reynolds begat Jennings, and each of them did a pretty fair job in his own right. You've always been very nice to me, so give this new anchor team for Nightline a fair break. If you don't, I promise you the network will just put another comedy show in this time slot, and then you'll be sorry. That's our report for tonight. I'm Ted Koppel in Washington. For all of us here at ABC News, good night.
Congratulations, Ted Koppel, on 25 years of great work. Top stories, if you're just waking up, it's 37 minutes past the hour. There's a change of status for the Dirty Bomber. Jose Padilla has been held for 3.5 years without charges being filed. The Bush people have fixed that. He's been charged, but not with plotting to blow up apartments here in the U.S., like they said. People and the media are starting to refocus their attention on New Orleans. Why? Because the job of reconstructing that city doesn't seem to be a federal priority anymore. And I think that's best evidenced by the fact that FEMA was getting ready to throw a whole bunch of people out of their hotels on December 1st. After a whole bunch of criticism, it appears as though they've backed up off of that. And that's a very interesting sidebar to this particular story, and we're going to get into that a little bit later. But certainly, we had yesterday the filmmaker who had from Frontline who had done a piece on Hurricane Katrina and its aftermath called The Storm. It was on last night on Frontline. And one of the things that he really kind of brought forward very, very forcefully is the idea that there's so much work still to be done in New Orleans. And now it looks as though many of the people who live in the city, many of the people who want to see the city come back, now believe that the government has lost interest. Can you imagine that? A government losing interest on a major American city. Just simply saying, well, whatever. Whatever happens, happens. Not, you know, it's, you know, congratulations to the first responders, congratulations to people, you know, that helped out. But we got other things to do. Other things, for example, than to track 6,644 people who are still missing in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. And, of course, the death toll thus far in Louisiana and Mississippi is something on the order of 1,306. Well, I don't know what happened to those other 6,644. If there's a God, most of them are safe and sound. All of them are safe and sound, in fact, and living someplace else, and there's just some bureaucratic snafu that has made it impossible for folks to try and figure out exactly where they are. Or the downside is that there may be a much higher death toll than a lot of people had originally thought. Now, again, we're talking about people in both parties saying that there are bottlenecks and bureaucratic red tape that have occurred in large part because of a leadership vacuum in Washington. And, of course, there's going to be a giant sucking sound in Washington in about 4 or 5 hours when the entire city leaves to go home for Thanksgiving without taking care of business with regard to Hurricane Katrina. And, you know, there is a question of how you manage to draw back the 150,000 people. I'm being real conservative about this. 150,000 people who left that city and are still not back yet. The population of New Orleans, by the way, before Katrina was something on the order of 500,000 people. Right now, the latest estimate I heard at the end of last week says that there are approximately 65,000 people out of 500,000 who are spending their nights and days in the city of New Orleans. How do you repopulate and rebuild and reconstruct a city if your government doesn't care? That's absurd. That's insane. That's criminal, given what this government apparently cares about, extending presidential power, keeping us in a war that apparently even our best military people think is problematic. How in the world do they turn their backs on an American city? Of course, I'm being facetious in asking that question because they did. They did in the immediate aftermath of the hurricane itself. But now it seems once the Klieg lights are turned down, once the cameras are turned off, once the media leaves, the government has left with it. And that is a tragedy that must be addressed. New Orleans, folks, is part of America. And as a result, ought to be treated as an American city. Now, after FEMA received a firestorm of complaints about their decision to stop paying hotel bills for people after, I'm talking about now, Hurricane Katrina evacuees, after December 1st, they backed up. And they've actually said now that they can, folks can stay in the hotels until the end of the year, which is great. I mean, that means people get to spend Christmas in hotels. Have any of you ever spent a Christmas in a hotel? It is no fun unless you're on a holiday somewhere. So don't think that like Barbara Bush thought, when she went to the Astrodome, that all these people are just having a great time, or that being in a hotel represents some great, welfare program for these folks, and they're just sitting back pimping off the government. That is nonsense. Most of these people just want a hand up, not a handout, a hand up, so that they can put their lives back together. And, speaking of putting our lives back together, we have been told for the last, 2 years or so, Brendan, that we're in the midst of this great economic expansion. Things are doing so well in America. The Dow Jones seems like it's going up every day. Google is selling for $400 a share. 400 bucks a share. It's incredible. GM is a penny stock, but Google is worth $400 a year. We are supposed to be in the midst of an extraordinary economic expansion. The only problem is an awful lot of people in this country don't seem to be down with the program. In other words, their economic life is not improving the way everybody else's is. Now, one of the things that's happened in terms of the economy is the simple fact that people, because the interest rates have been low and because there's been money that people have accumulated as the value of their homes has shot up, a lot of people have been taking money out of their houses, okay, in the form of refinancing. My sister did it the other day. She had her kitchen redone. And in order to do that, you have to take money out of your house. You take some of your equity out of your house. That's a wonderful thing, but doesn't work for everybody because not everybody owns a home. For a lot of people in this society, Thanksgiving Day is going to be a matter of scuffling to get by. Christmas is going to be difficult. There are a lot of people in America are going to have to tell their children no. Now, that's no big deal. I was told no all the time when it comes to the holidays when I was growing up. If my family didn't have the money to buy something I wanted, I just didn't get it. It was as simple as that. But the fact is that America is fast becoming two Americas. One, relatively affluent, doing well, beneficiaries of tax cuts, that sort of thing. And another America that is scuffling to survive. And the problem is that the first America thinks it can survive being oblivious to the second America. And that, to me, is a problem. I want to find out on this Thanksgiving Eve how you're coping in our listening audience here at Air America Radio. 866-303-2270 is our phone number. 866-303-2270. Tell us if you're coping. And by the way, this is not limited to people who aren't doing well, okay? If you're doing well, and we've had people who've called here and said, hey, my life is great, call us and tell us. Tell us exactly how you managed to make your life great. And tell us whether you think that maybe there aren't as many people who are scuffling from paycheck to paycheck as maybe we think. Maybe we're being alarmists about this from your vantage point. But I want to find out, from people who are maybe on their way out the door this morning, people who've got to go to work and earn a living today, whether or not you've been able to survive and thrive in this current Bush-fed economy. Because it doesn't seem as though this president, other than tax cuts, really gives a crap about the economy, to be honest with you. It's kind of like virtually everybody for themselves. At least that's what I've been given to see. That's what I see when I look kind of assess the world that's around me. What are you seeing? 866-303-2270 is our phone number. We'll talk to you next. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition. Call us at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270.
Call me, doggy.
Minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron has a well-deserved day off. If you're just joining us, welcome. Here's what's happening as you scratch the sleep out of your eyes. Troop cuts in Iraq? Could be. Depends on who you talk to. Maybe Condoleezza Rice, our Secretary of State. She's saying it is entirely possible. The Pentagon, according to published reports, is saying it's possible. Senator Barack Obama of Illinois wants the president to come clean about errors he made in the run-up and the conduct of the Iraq War. We know, of course, that this is a president who doesn't really admit to making errors at all. So, nice try, Senator, but I don't think so. An American Muslim has been convicted of plotting to assassinate, said President Bush. He's facing life in prison when he's sentenced on February 17th. Tom DeLay didn't get his charges thrown out like his lawyer wanted. The judge in the case, whose name is Pat Priest, and I kept thinking, why does that name seem to ring a bell? Because there was a female named Pat Priest that was in the TV series The Munsters. Not a bit of trivia that nobody really cares about but me. But anyway, Judge Pat Priest told Tom DeLay, no, I'm not going to rush through all this stuff and rush through a question of whether or not to dismiss your indictment just so you can run to be House Majority Leader again. Apparently, he said, I got a lot of other things on my plate. How tough is it to keep your head above water, economically speaking? That's what we're asking you at 866-303-2270. Everyone's talking about what a great, at least all the media is talking about what a great economy we have, but it's not great for everyone. And again, we're inviting you to call whether the economy's good to you or bad to you. We're going to start out talking to Larry, who's calling us from Minnesota. Larry, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Mark. Glad to have you on the air. I tell you, you and Mark Maron, you guys are the only guys that really speak for us here, the working poor people.
Well, we try, man. Thanks a lot for that.
I work full-time, and I, after benefits, after my 6% that goes to 401k, because there won't be no Social Security after this administration.
Good point.
My full paycheck before taxes and benefits is $389. After the benefits, and I get paid every week, last week my paycheck was $162.
Now, Larry, how do you make good? How do you live in Minnesota? I'm not sure. Are you in Minneapolis?
I'm in the Minneapolis area.
All right, in
my
Minneapolis area.
My partner and I put our money together, and we do the best we can. But, you know, this is a scary time. And the one thing we both agree is even if the administration gets totally replaced tomorrow, it will take years to recover from the damage that's been done in our country.
Now, Larry, tell me one thing that you have to think about cutting back on because your salary and your partner's salary is low enough that where you really are scuffling.
We're very minimal on our food that we buy. We're very selective. And we, of course, have wrote everybody cards, letting them know that there will be no Christmas this year.
All right. Larry, listen, thanks a lot for calling and sharing that with us.
Thank you.
Take care. Let's go next to Gregory, who's calling us from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Gregory, good morning. How you doing?
Mark, how you doing, man?
Good, man.
You guys are doing a good service. I just like to tell you real quick about being a conservative friend of mine and make a point that I think the country don't talk enough about.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, I'll make that point first in case you want to cut us off. These people that are in the White House, these are not Christian people. You know, I grew up in the church. I'm a Christian. These people are not Christian.
Gregory, let me stop you there. Why do you think I would cut you off for saying that?
No, but I mean, the timing, you know.
I understand, I understand.
And the Christian people in this country need to wake up and understand, just because somebody say, I'm a Christian, that don't mean you throw your support behind them, because it was the very right of the church that put Christ on the cross. It wasn't the world.
It was
very right of the church that hung Christ on the cross. and if Christ was walking the earth today, I don't think he'd be involved in political parties. He'd be looking out for the very people that these people don't care about. But I tell you about this scenario on my job. A good friend of mine, he's a good friend of mine, but he's extremely radical. And he came to me 3 years ago, and he said, if Bush had complete control, this with these Democrats just stonewalling everything in Washington, this country would be better. Well, the other day he came to me with all of this frustration. I could just see it on his face and a lot of these other people to the right, because this country is in a mess. And they have nobody to blame.
Yeah, exactly. They really don't. And Gregory, thank you so much for calling. We do have to move on to another call. But you're right. There is nobody to blame but the people who implemented the policies. Let's go next to Helen, who's calling us from Dallas, Texas. Helen, good morning. How's things going in your area?
Hi, good morning. I'm in the Dallas, Texas area, and I don't see any improvement. Actually, I see that I haven't got a raise in like 2 years myself, and even then, since I had been laid off back in 2001, way before the September 11th thing, then when I did finally find a job, it was paying a lot less than I had made previously. And then they say, well, you're at the top of this level, blah, blah, blah. And so now I find that, you know, I can't, you know, with the gas prices and everything, at least I live close to my job, so that's a good thing.
Yeah.
But with gas and everything else, food and everything else going up every day, it's like, you know, I've actually had a raise. I've had a cut in pay when you look at all of the stuff. And then our benefits went up again this year. We had our open enrollment just recently.
Oh, for health benefits?
Yeah, our health benefits. Uh-huh. They went up another 8%, which they've been doing every year, you know.
You know what, Helen? 7%. You're not alone. There are millions of people who have found that their paychecks, even if they get small raises every year, which you have not for the last 2 years, but even if they get small raises, their small raises do not keep up with the cost of living. You've got poverty on the rise. You've got wage gains among the slowest on record. Pensions
exactly.
are vanishing before people's eyes. And think about this now for a minute. Uh-huh. Energy prices are so high.
Right.
And oil profiteers are so greedy
exactly.
that a foreign head of government can mm-hmm. come here and seriously offer the American people a break on home heating oil when the other oil companies who are based here essentially said nothing. That is very, very deep to think about. Helen, thank you very, very much for that phone call. Man, that's been fun talking to people on the phone. We're going to do that throughout the hour, actually the next hour and throughout the morning today, because we got some great guests. But I love to talk to people on the telephones because it really does get to where people live and how people are living. So stay with us. We're going to talk about Jose Padilla. We're going to talk about the other Muslim, Abu Ali, who's been convicted on plotting to assassinate George W. Bush. We're going to talk about the Vatican issuing a document banning gays from the priesthood. So what else is new? Stay with us. It's 57 minutes past the hour. Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
This is Larry King.
Good morning. It's 6 minutes past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron has a well-deserved day off. Good morning to people who are already planning their mall trips for the day after Thanksgiving. Good morning to those who will be working tomorrow. Special good morning to those who walk to work. Good morning to caregivers, first responders, the butchers, the bakers, and yes, indeed, the candlestick makers. If you're just waking up this day before Thanksgiving, a lot of things going on. Jose Padilla, the so-called dirty bomber, indicted after 3 years in detention where the Bush administration was trying to keep him away from the U.S. court system. So now they indict him, and they're going to try him in that same U.S. court system. The court system in Virginia has convicted an American-born Muslim for plotting to assassinate President George W. Bush. He is facing life in prison when he's sentenced next February. Tom DeLay did not manage to get his charges, his criminal charges, thrown out by a judge in Texas. Instead, the judge, saying, I have a lot on my plate, said that he will be considering whether or not to throw out those charges. But if a trial comes, it won't happen this year, and that makes it real difficult for Tom DeLay to try and re-grab some power in Washington. The Pentagon is talking about a troop with troop reduction. I shouldn't say troop withdrawal. I guess withdrawal sounds less patriotic. But the troop with reduction in Iraq of up to three brigades. One of those brigades might end up in Kuwait, but a three-brigade reduction would be just over 10,000 people. And it looks like the scenario that we've been talking about here at Morning Sedition for a good long while now, that scenario being that Republican lawmakers could not afford midterm elections next year with the current level of troop strength in Iraq without any end to the war in sight. That scenario is now starting little by little, inch by inch, to play itself out. Even as the Bush administration, even as President Bush and Vice President Cheney, you know, natter on about people being unpatriotic what else was it? It was disingenuous and all these other kinds of terms. The fact of the matter is, it looks like they are going to have to withdraw those troops sooner or later. And the Vatican, you know the Vatican, even if you're not Catholic, you know about the Vatican. The Vatican has issued yet another document saying that gays should not be priests. Now, that kind of seems like closing the barn door after the horses run the derby, let me not accused of mocking anyone's religion. I just get a sense that there have been gays in the priesthood for some time now, at least certainly in terms of some of the abuse that the church has already admitted to. But let's go beyond that for a moment. Let us ask ourselves precisely what they mean when they say anyone who supports, quote, the gay culture. Kent Jones, what is the gay culture? Kent doesn't know. Chris Lopresto? I know you've had a couple of experimental moments. What's the gay culture? never mind.
I can't speak about it.
You can't speak about it? Brendan McDonald, what's the gay culture?
Well, you know, there is a gay culture, though. That's the thing.
What? You mean like Judy Garland and Cher?
Yeah, see, that's the stereotyped culture. But there is definitely a gay culture. And I think that the language there is trying to use that in the derogatory sense as if it's, you know, some kind of it's always associated with it being a choice, you know.
Oh yeah, yeah,
say,
yeah.
Oh, you're part of that culture. You chose to be.
You chose to be, yeah, because it is a cultural / lifestyle decision, not something that you're born with. I mean, a lot of people in the so-called Christian community are trying to build their foundation on that particular rock, and I think it's nonsense. But hey, what are you going to do? It appears as though, and again, you know, these Vatican documents come out in cyclicals or however they put them out. Periodically talking about exactly who can and who cannot be eligible for the priesthood. They still, in my judgment, have not come up with a viable, valid reason why women can't become priests. Never mind. All right, you want to eliminate all the gays? Fine. But what about women? Is there something about their culture that precludes them from being priests? Is there something about their lifestyle? Is there something, some deep-seated tendency that nobody but the Vatican knows about? It's a very, very strange scenario. We've been talking with you before our hour break about the economy and about the two economies that seem to be working in America. One where people seem to be doing pretty well. Their investments are doing well. They're getting those Bush tax cuts. Things seem to be going swimmingly for some people in our society, folks that can take equity out of their homes, et cetera. And then there are other people who live day-to-day or paycheck-to-paycheck. We just talked to somebody who has to make $162 take-home stretch over a week. Now, in New York, that would be literally physically impossible unless you lived in the subway or something. But in other parts of the country, you know, we here in New York think that the cost of living in other places is so low that $162 can actually get somebody through an average week. We just heard from someone in Minnesota who says, well, at least not here. Let's go to our phone lines right now, 866-303-2270, and find out how you're coping with the economy. Here's Joe from Portland, Oregon. Joe, good morning. How you doing?
All right. How are you?
Good. What's on your mind? Bring it.
You're talking about economy. I want to know what the heck the economy is, man. I would have to quit my job and go on welfare in order to be able to make it.
Really? I mean, what's your situation now?
I'm a security guard right now, working graveyards from 12 at night till 8 in the morning here in Portland.
Hey, I've done it. I've done it here in New York. I know the feeling.
I'm making $8 an hour, so I bring home $1,100 a month after taxes and trying to support a wife and a six-year-old son.
A wife and a six-year-old son on how much? $1,000 a month?
$1,100 a month.
$1,100 a month. And your rent, I assume, or your mortgage payment is pretty
high. Yeah, we're renting at $750 for a two-bedroom house. We couldn't get an apartment any cheaper. This guy here just happens to have a hardwood floor company right behind it, so I watch his property, and he picks up the electric, the garbage, and the water for us.
Mm.
Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to afford that. It's a shame because, I mean, we went down and even tried to apply for food stamps. We're above the poverty level, so we get no medical from the state, no food stamps, no nothing. My company just had an open enrollment for family medical, which is $298 a month, so that would leave us $2 a month to eat on.
Oh, my God. Wait a minute. $298 a month on top of $700 or $750 for rent, and you make $1,100. So,
So we got a choice, be healthy or eat.
Yeah, right? Be healthy or eat when you're supposed to be healthy when you eat. That's incredible.
Right.
Incredible. Joe, hey, keep it up, man. Keep on keeping on. Whatever you got to do, all right?
Hey, you know, like I said, I tell people out here, man, you can make a better living as a criminal than you can as an honest man. So.
Well, hey, man, stay honest for us. Joe, thanks a lot. You take care. Wow. You can make more money as a criminal than you can living as an honest man. And he's a security guard. I know what that was like, you know, having to do that graveyard shift. And, by the way, when I did it, I only made $2.15 an hour for it. Show you how long ago it was. Let's go next to Leon, who's calling us from Hollywood, Florida. Leon, good morning.
Good morning to you, man.
How are you?
I'm good. Just driving to school this morning.
All right. Bring it. What's on your mind?
Well, let me just say, I'm from a family of complete immigrants. We came to this country really just about 20-something years ago without speaking English or without being able to read the language or understanding anything.
Where'd you come from, Leon?
I came from Israel.
Israel, okay.
Israel. And really, we came from Israel in the late 70s when there was nothing there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was when we came here, my parents really had no help. No one really helped them. They came here. They pretty much developed their own business. They learned the language on their own. They got into the society on their own, and they succeeded. They developed four of their own businesses from nothing.
Now, how did they get the seed money to invest in those businesses?
They worked in horrible jobs for about 5 years. They worked below minimum wage. They cleaned dishes. They bust tables.
Mm-hmm.
They used to hang T-shirts in stores. You know?
Okay.
I mean, they did anything they could just to make a buck.
And they just saved all their money.
And they saved every penny that they made.
Okay. It's a laudable story. It's a great story. It's a story that is repeated time and time again in America. True.
Yeah, I mean, my family's an example of the American dream.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to tell you, these past two and a half years, we've been taking a nearly 30% reduction in our profits.
Really? For why? Why would that be?
Honestly, from what I'm asking the customers, because we own retail stores, what I'm asking the customers in the stores is that really they're afraid to spend money. They fear that the money they spend isn't going to be returned to them when they go back to work the next day. Because the majority of our customers are blue collar workers. You know, we have stores on the shore.
Mm-hmm.
They come to the shore, you know, for a weekend with their family, and they really can't afford to spend that much anymore.
Leon, let me ask you this: Does your family businesses, do they get tax breaks, or does that simply go to the corporate, the established big corporation?
We're not feeling any tax breaks, man. I got to tell you the truth.
Really?
Not feeling many tax breaks. Honestly, I feel that really major publicly owned corporations are getting much larger tax breaks than privately owned sectors. And I think that perhaps the government believes that if they give larger taxes to publicly owned sectors, they could hire more employees, which really isn't the case because we see GM just fired, like 30,000 employees?
30,000 employees. Rather than develop a hybrid car, they fired 30,000 employees.
Right.
You know, a great business move.
But let me just say, I mean, I'm not bashing this country. I love this country.
Mm-hmm.
This country has been amazing to me and my family. Everything I have, because I can go to school today because I live in America.
I understand.
Had I been in Israel, it would have been near impossible to make a living in Israel. It's very, very difficult.
Well, you know what? Again, this is true whether you come from Israel or from Trinidad.
From
any country, you do have the opportunity. And unfortunately, for a lot of people in this country, Leon, thank you very much for the call. There are a lot of people in this country who, for one reason or another, are unable to replicate that kind of success story in their own lives. Not because they're stupid, not because they, you know, simply want the government to support them, but because the circumstances under which they come up inside this country makes it quite problematic for them to build anything and struggle and survive at it. Now, that's not to say that there aren't people, native-born Americans, who go through that same model. But, you know, in many instances, you have situations where people simply cannot cope. When they simply, you know, you can't save money on $162 a week. Believe me when I tell you. But listen, thanks for that call. It's 17 minutes past the hour. We're going to take a quick one. Come back. We got some guests coming up in this hour from the 13th Annual African Diaspora Film Festival. So stay with us. It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Morning's Edition on the air. MorningsEdition.com, Air America Radio.
Twenty-two minutes past the hour. It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron will be back with you on Monday. I'll be off for the following week and rejoin you on the following Monday. I hope that that made sense for people. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't, but trust me, Maron will be back next Monday. If you're just waking up, if you just want to know what's going on, Jose Padilla has been indicted in papers that were unsealed in Miami yesterday. He has not been charged with being a dirty bomber. He has not been charged with any of the things that we heard he was alleged to have done when he was first picked up 3.5 years ago. He is now charged with plotting to murder and maim people outside the United States. This, of course, actually gives the Bush administration some very interesting cover, and we're going to go into that in a very short, short minute. Tom DeLay, also dealing with the court system, he is now going to have to deal with the idea of waiting, and perhaps waiting until past the time when he can try to retake his House Majority Leader's gig to have the government, in this case the government in Texas, a judge in Texas, rule on whether or not his indictment on criminal charges, money laundering charges that is, should be squashed or dropped. And it's possible that may still happen. The judge said that he might yet do it, but he's going to do it in his own time. And as Judge Pat Priest in Texas said, I got a lot on my plate, all right? So kind of like leave me alone. So Tom DeLay is not going to be, I don't think, able to jump back into his role as House Majority Leader, something he really does want to do badly because Republicans have not exactly been burning on all cylinders since he's kind of had to step down. And, of course, many of his friends and associates are also looking to replace him in that situation. The Pentagon is talking about the possibility of reducing by 3 brigades, some 10,500 combat troops, the U.S. troop strength in Iraq. Isn't it interesting that the Pentagon is saying this, according to published reports, at the same time that the Bush administration is slamming anyone who talks about the possibility of a troop withdrawal in Iraq? How does that make sense? Well, greater minds than mine will have to figure that one out. And greater minds than mine will have to figure out exactly what the Bush administration was thinking in terms of Jose Padilla. They ought to be indicted for cowardice. I'm talking about the administration now, in bringing these charges against Jose Padilla after what they said he had done when they locked him up. It's obvious that the administration does not want a court showdown, does not want the United States Supreme Court to decide whether or not the Bush administration has the power to hold Jose Padilla as an enemy combatant indefinitely. Mind you, they can reclassify him as an enemy combatant because, of course, when they indicted him, he no longer was considered an enemy combatant. He will, I guess, be facing trial now on some conspiracy charge to murder, kidnap, and maim people outside the United States. That we've got a timeline of his behavior that says he's no angel, that's for sure. But he is an American, and it would seem as if he should be treated as an American. And what we're really looking at here, folks, if you dig beneath the surface just a little bit and go beyond Jose Padilla and what he's alleged to have done just a little bit, is a titanic struggle between the administration and the court system about the extent and the use of presidential power. And I believe that George W. Bush is, see, because keeping people incognito as an enemy combatant is, to me, a fascistic tendency, all right? If you trust the American court system, you trust the American court system. You can't be halfway for the courts. You can't be halfway for the American system of justice. If it's good enough for some guy on the street, if it's good enough for Tom DeLay, why isn't it up until now, or why hasn't it been good enough for Jose Padilla? The fact of the matter is the Bush administration wants to be able to keep the Jose Padillas in the world incognito, away from legal representation. Jose Padilla was over a year and a half, 18 months, incarcerated without any legal representation. What's up with that? How do you excuse that? How do you justify that kind of fascism? Because that's what fascists do. Fascists lock people up without charge. Fascists tend to put people away and not want them to see the light of day. Fascists are the ones that incrementally try to expand presidential power, and actually in many instances, and this is one of them, by doing an end around the American court system. We're going to come back and talk about the 13th annual African Diasporan Film Festival with two participants, one of whom is the founder. Stay with us. This is Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
With Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. It's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley, and it is the day before Thanksgiving. So I hope everybody has a good day today, and you're able to sit in the house and relax and enjoy yourselves tomorrow. If you are just joining us, a bunch of things going on in the world this morning. Jose Padilla, the so-called dirty bomber, has been indicted, but not for being a dirty bomber. They're talking about the possibility of three brigades being stood down in Iraq. I guess Congressman John Murtha had a little bit bigger effect than a lot of people thought, and certainly a lot more of an effect than most people in Washington gave him credit for. Senator Barack Obama wants George W. Bush to come clean about errors in Iraq. Yeah, well, that'll happen. And we're also, of course, talking and have been talking to you this morning about how you're keeping your economic head above water, because that is a tough, tough job. But in studio, we've got some guests starting this Friday. The city of New York will be the place to see 80 films from 30 countries celebrating the African experience in film. We are joined in studio this morning by Dr. Ronaldo Barroso-Speck and Rochelle Gardner. Dr. Barroso-Speck is the visionary behind the 13th annual African Diaspora Film Festival here in New York. Rochelle Gardner's film, Harlem's Mart 125, The American Dream, is featured in the festival. Good to have you both in studio this morning. Thanks for being with
you.
Us.
Good morning.
Thank Much
you.
Appreciated. Let me start out with Rochelle Gardner, because you did a film about a place that's kind of near and dear to my heart. Mart 125, when I used to do broadcasts from the Apollo, the first place I'd hop when I got out of there was right across the street to Mart 125. I knew a lot of the merchants there. I knew the struggle, the history of struggle there. What drew you, a relatively young person, to make this film?
Well, I always wanted to make films, and this film came out of the inspiration, actually, of my husband, Val, who... I had quit my job working at this, at the Queen Latifah show, and okay. I was tired of the negative images constantly portrayed, not only in that show, but in the industry as, you know, just tired of the negative images. So my husband and I were walking through Harlem, you know, where we live, obviously, and we just had this conversation about, like, wow, what is going on with this transformation of Harlem? And he's just like, you know, instead of being so frustrated about what's going on in the industry, maybe you should document what's going on right here in Harlem. And because the issue of the changes that are going on are so broad, I decided to stick with the Mart, because the Mart was definitely a symbol in my in my, you know, growing up, going to college, having to cross 125th Street, go into the mart, get something to eat, or find out what's going on in the community, buy something. And the mart, to me, was a symbol of black entrepreneurship.
Mm.
You know, something that was seen in the mart. It was, it, you know, it's just a, and that's why it kind of drove me to
Make the film. Yeah, it's interesting because I remember when the mart first started, and it was the idea that they were going to bring some of the people who had been street vendors along 125th Street into an enclosed space and let them kind of grow their businesses. And there were flower. There was a flower store. There was a woman named Ruby that used to cater out of there. There were a record and CD place that was really great, as a matter of fact. But it always seemed as though the mart was problematic in terms of whether or not the powers that be were going to let it continue to exist the way it was. And there seemed to be some problems getting people to, you know, shop at Mart 125. What did your film experience that way?
Well, actually, my film really exposes the positive part of the mart because this film actually, it took me about 6 years to do, and it's still somewhat of a work in progress.
Okay.
I'm still tweaking it and trying to fine-tune it. But, you know, I think what you brought up is definitely relevant, is that there were many political problems that occurred in the mart. The mart was founded, or it was put together because they wanted to get the street vendors off the streets in the 80s.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of meant to fail, but when it opened for the community, it was the first time where, you know, the community, people in the neighborhood could shop with people who look like themselves. And it was historic in the sense because we look at Harlem as this black mecca of the world, but we don't realize that a lot of the shops and the merchants who own the stores on 125th Street, you know, are not people who look like us.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like the mart was really a place where you can go and shop in the mall, where you see brothers and sisters who look just like your parents or your uncles or your, you know, sisters. So the film really, I use the mart as really a metaphor to show what's going on in the community.
In the greater Harlem community.
Yes. So,
and it's the most famous black community in the world.
Absolutely. So I mean, yeah. And I felt as though if I use the history of the mart, of how it started and the people behind it and where it is now, that I could kind of open the doors to talk about other issues going on in the community.
All right. Our other guest is Dr. Rinaldo Barroso-Speck, who's been doing this now for 13 years, organizing, the founder and organizer of the African Diaspora Film Festival. Dr. Speck, tell us a little bit about what, I mean, this has really grown and expanded over time. What was your inspiration?
The inspiration basically was my being in a city like this one and being exposed to the diversity in the city. In the classroom, I am a teacher. I'm still teaching. I teach a course at, I am an adjunct professor at Teachers College, Columbia University. And all that information that I was gathering in the streets, in the classrooms, I was rarely presented on the big screen. I am a film buff. When I came into the city, I mean, I had already these images and ideas that I had gathered in other big cities of the world. And between my wife and I, we thought about this because we know perfectly well the importance of films as an educational component in the life of people. So it began that way. With no pretensions, we were not interested in being part of the industry because, to be honest, we didn't know much about the industry. We knew about film. We knew about the need to have a more accurate depiction of the life of people of color. Those days, we were not using very, very frequently the expression, the global black experience, but we knew perfectly well that the life of people of color had been determined by that phenomenon of being of African descent, either in Europe, where we came from, either in the Latin America, where we came from, and things like that. So it was an experiment, to be honest. And I remember sitting down with Haile Gerima, the director of Sankofa,
sure,
in Montreal, Canada, And he was telling us, well, I don't know where to show my film in New York City because all the doors have been closed. I said, well, look, we have a film festival. No one is going to tell us what to play in it. So if you give us your film, you're going to see it up there.
I saw Sankofa, in fact, at the African Diaspora Film Fest. That was the first place I saw it.
You see, and the rest is history.
Absolutely. How many films were there in that first film festival?
I think there was a number of maybe 20, 25, something like that.
So you've quadrupled since then, the last 13 years.
Yes, I mean, I remember that day, I mean, that year in 1993, there was just one venue, the Cinema Village. This year we have five venues, I mean,
five different places here in New York.
Yes, and we're going to be playing films in five places in New York, having the panel discussions and things like that. We are bigger now. Also, I mean, the African Diaspora Film Festival is put together by Art Matin Productions, which is now a more professional film distribution company. And the company, I mean, expanded the event. So today, the African Diaspora Film Festival has smaller versions in Chicago, in Jersey City, okay, in Curacao, in the Dutch Caribbean. We are now seriously talking with people in D.C. and things like that.
Oh, that's fantastic. So it really is expanding by leaps and bounds.
Yes.
And I mean, I saw the work of people like Raoul Peck and others at the African Diaspora Film Festival. Tell us, in addition to Rochelle Gardner's film, what are some of the other films that are being screened and the ones that you like?
Okay, well, I like them all.
I know.
I like
them
all.
We ain't got time for 80 films.
But I have to say that the opening night film is going to be an interesting program. We have Nelson George. We
call I know Nelson for years.
That's right. So he's going to be there with his film Smart Black People, and he's going to make comments on Urban Soul. Both films are complementary because they cover this important period of the 80s. There was a moment of definition in music, aesthetics, and many things in the black community here and outside. Then we have a package that we call the Afro-Quebec cinema. And there's one film, In the Verge of a Fever, which is a nice comedy. At the French Institute, one of the venues we are using this year. We're talking about The Miracle of Candial. We have a lot of music in the film festival this year. The Miracle of Candial, the meeting of two giants of Afro-Latino music, Carlinhos Brown.
Carlinhos Brown from Brazil, sure.
And Bebo Valdez, the father of Chucho Valdez from Irakere and all that.
Sure.
So they meet in Bahia, they walk around Bahia, they talk about music, they talk about political situation. There's
oh God, don't get me started about Bahia, man.
You see,
I've been there twice. And you start talking about it, I might want to buy a plane.
And you go crazy, you know. So I mean, now we're moving to Papa Wemba, talking about music again. The Importance of Being Elegant is a film about, I mean, this trend that he created with fashion, music, and all that. Papa Wemba is now in exile in Paris. Moving out of this area, we go into the African-American component. We have more than 20 films directed by African-American directors, and this one that we brought back because of its importance today, I'm talking about The Dinner by Bernie Casey.
Oh, sure.
We had this film some years ago, but I think the film is still relevant. I was last night speaking with Bernie on the phone, and he said, well, I mean, I'm glad that you're still paying attention to my little work. So the film is back here, and we have comedies. I mean, we have this music theme that appears.
Runs the gamut. No.
Exactly. And we have a small homage to black men in World War II. It's very small, four films, but we are bringing back Jewels of African Cinema by Ousmane Sembène. We're talking about The Camp of the Arroyo. We're talking about.
I saw that at the
Emitai. We're talking about Tasuma the Fighter. This year was Fespaco year in Ouagadougou, the capital of Burkina Faso. And Tasuma the Fighter won the third big prize in Fespaco. And it is the story of a former World War II veteran who, after all these years, had not seen a penny. I mean, he hasn't been able to get his pension.
Oh,
and
wow.
One day he decided that he must be paid. he got to get paid. And then we have an old film, I mean, an old classic, Soldier Story.
Soldier, oh, yeah.
It is a small package, a small homage to, we are celebrating 60 years of the end of World War II, right?
Absolutely.
Well, we wanted to pay homage to black soldiers in World War II.
Now, we're just about out of time. I want to make sure people know when Rochelle Gardner's film about Mark 125 is going to be shown.
Okay, it's going to be shown this Sunday at the Anthology Film Archives at 7:20. And, you know, again, I'm honored to be in this film festival because this film festival is so important because it brings all films mm-hmm. from all over the diaspora to venues where people can see different cultures and experience that. And, you know, I think that's what my film brings, too, because it shows when, you know, the Africans came in the 90s, this is like a large exodus of Africans came to vend on the streets that, you know, we were kind of one.
Yeah.
You know, so it's
I remember those days.
Yeah, so I'm really honored to be in this film festival, and I hope people can come out not only to see my films, but all the films, because you have great...
You got 80 films,
and they're amazing.
Yeah, that's right. Now, the Anthology Film Archives is located on 2nd Avenue, 32 2nd Avenue, between 2nd... 2nd Street and 2nd Avenue here in New York City. And the African Diaspora Film Festival is going to be shown in 5 different venues from November 25th, which is the day after Thanksgiving, through December 11th. Dr. Rochelle, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us. Stay with us.
We're going to be right back with more. It's 48 minutes past the hour. Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your vlog. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
I'm 53 minutes past the hour. This is Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is off today. Here are some of the stories that we are tracking for you. The Vatican, once again, has issued a document banning gays from the priesthood. I guess maybe if they keep doing this long enough, they figure that they will just ban gays, period. The United Kingdom has charged an official for leaking that story that we told you about yesterday where Tony Blair had to talk George W. Bush out of bombing Al Jazeera in a friendly country, that country being Qatar. Someone, a civil servant, has been charged under Britain's Official Secrets Act. Americans, as we have talked to you about and talked with you all morning about, are not feeling the effects of the so-called economic recovery, certainly not evenly. Some people are doing well. Other folks are struggling. There are still more than 6,000 people missing in Louisiana in the now aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, and it looks as though legislation that would affect the reconstruction of New Orleans is dormant. It is not on anybody's agenda. It may not even be on many people's radar. So which is worse, Dave? Dave, a little Goliath now. We haven't had him on yet this morning. Which is worse, bad fruit or bad meat? Go ahead.
I think bad meat is worse. Than
bad meat
fruit.
Is worse. Well, yeah. You'd be wrong.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
According to
that's
this,
why he's eating garlic knots.
Yeah, I know. He eats garlic knots every morning.
Fruit. Yeah.
Yeah, scares off the contamination of anything. As a matter of fact, are you one of those Esther? No, that's not Esther. It's garlic. No, garlic is the one that Larry King used to sell all the time.
Well, garlic is very healthy. It. I think it's like an anti-carcinogenic. Thing.
an anti-carcinogenic thing.
Yeah, it prevents cancer.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And what presents the bad breath that it gives you?
Brushing your teeth every morning.
Well, no, and you have to brush your teeth every minute after you have some
you
of those knots you bring in.
A cup of water or something, you know.
Ah, okay. Well, actually, the Center for Science in the Public Interest, which is a pretty reputable group, now says that contaminated fruits and vegetables are causing more foodborne illnesses among Americans than raw chicken or eggs or any other meat product. Now, can you get to that, Dave? Well, never mind. I don't want to tax you too much. Apparently, fruits and vegetables triggered 31 outbreaks from 2002 to 2003, compared to 29 for chicken and other poultry. Now, I don't know. That doesn't really count like mad cow or any of these other diseases, I guess. I guess they're only talking about chicken or chicken products. And, of course, as a lover of chicken, this scares the bejesus right out of me. But apparently food and fruits and vegetables are a little bit more problematic than most people think, which I guess, can't you get rid of most of that stuff if you wash it properly? And if you buy it at a reputable place where the food, you know, where the produce is actually fresh, maybe an organic type joint? Crystal Presto, I know you're a big organic food shopper, aren't you?
Sure. I do go to the Green Market a lot.
You go to Green Market?
Yes.
What, in Bay Ridge? They got a Green Market?
No, over here in Union Square.
Oh, you go to Union Square's Green Market? Yeah, what do you get when you go? You get that bacon and stuff, though.
No, I get the Honey Crisp apples.
Honey? Oh, yeah. Well, the apples are great, especially now.
And when I was in Seattle, I went to the public market over there, and all that stuff is organic.
Oh, yeah. Their stuff is great over there. Now, there's a guy in Great Britain who lived in Houston for 4 years who has been diagnosed with that Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, the human form of mad cow. So I guess this whole thing about, you know, meat not being as bad as fruit really doesn't play for him.
Yeah, if fruit's going to give you a little food poisoning, I'd rather have that than the meat-eating disease that eats your brain.
Brain out, yeah. This guy had lived apparently in the United Kingdom from 1980 to 1996, and then he ended up living in Houston for 4 years, and now he's got mad cow. Where he got it from? Anybody's guess. Now, you know, we had a lot of people who called us when Maren and I were talking about good cars that are road reliable and that sort of thing. Well, guess what ended up being Motor Trend's car of the year for this year? Chris Lopresto, are you ready for this?
Yes, I am.
The Honda Civic.
Nice.
Not exactly an American-made car, but it is the Honda Civic, and all of the Civic models, including the hybrid, made the cut.
I own one of those.
Yeah, they're great cars, man. I mean, how are you going to argue with that? Now, in our final hour of Morning's Edition, we have got for you a discussion of all things technical with MSNBC's technical reporter, and we talk to Mark Green, the Goliath of Gotham, all coming up for you. It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio, 57 minutes past the hour. Minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is off today. He will be back with you next Monday. And we want to say a special good morning to all those people who don't think blacks should be on Air America Radio, except on the weekends. Good morning to all drummers, especially those who can't stop playing no matter what. Good morning to all students who may be getting tested over the next couple of weeks or so. Special good morning to all those who will march in the Thanksgiving Day Parade, wherever it is, in Macy's here in New York, or Toronto, or Philadelphia, I think, has a big one. There are Thanksgiving Day parades all over America. And they would not be parades unless people, of course, marched in them. Finally, good morning to all those dedicated to the pursuit of finding and sharing great music, no matter how you do it. Wayne Gilman, good morning.
Good morning, Mark Riley.
How are you?
I guess I'm a little disturbed by that call that Brendan received.
Brendan McDonald?
Ago. Yeah, you know.
Brendan handled his
that
business.
That was a wild one. I wish we could have put it on the air, but we would have had to dump it every 5 seconds.
Oh, really? It was like that?
She's a little old lady sounding, too.
Articulate, huh?
Articulate with the seven words we can't say on the air.
Uh-huh.
Well, first she said that Larry King was an a-hole and that she didn't know why we kept airing him. So that's where I thought the conversation was going.
Uh-huh.
But then it got into... That why is Mark Riley here? Because it sounds like the Sharpton Dinkins hour on the weekend.
Ooh.
So I had to deal with that for a little
power
while.
Power to the people. How
yeah.
you like that?
Yeah.
But yeah, apparently she says it was nothing having to do with race. She had no problem with black people, to which I said she just doesn't have any problem dealing with black people on the weekends.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's okay on the weekends.
Yeah. Right.
So, wait, you're going to get a show on the weekend?
I gladly would stay home as long as I get paid, which is typical of some blacks I know. So.
There you go. There we go.
Bill Cosby, call us now.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, really.
Right? Yeah.
But you know, Wayne and I have worked together for 30 some odd years, and we have experienced all manner of racism. Wayne Gilman, in fact, covered the busing situation in Canarsie back in the early 1970s
uh-huh.
and was spat on by right. Probably the same woman that's married.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, what was it? He's from the black station.
Exactly.
Get him.
No, the colored station.
Oh, the colored
at
station.
At that time.
Yeah, this was in the 70s. We hadn't right. gotten all the way. Black right. hadn't gotten to Canarsie
exactly.
yet.
Exactly.
Of course, Canarsie now is about, 65%
mostly,
black, I think.
Yeah, yeah. You know, but there's still some sections of that community that you can't walk through at night.
Really? The times, they are a-changing. Now, one of the things that we have not talked about yet this morning is the fact that Cindy Sheehan, one of my personal heroes, mm-hmm. by the way, is she's not down there. Oh, okay, she's not feeling well. She's not down there. But they have set up Camp Casey again. And we've got somebody on the telephones from Crawford, Texas, from the Crawford Peace House. Let's say good morning to, is that Hottie? Hottie, good morning. How you doing?
Good morning. I'm just doing just fine.
Well, thanks a lot for being with us. Now, Cindy is ill, huh?
She's not ill herself. Her daughter took ill.
Oh.
And she will be with us. She'll be coming to Crawford tomorrow. Tomorrow is Thursday.
Yeah.
I got up early this morning, so I'm trying to catch up. She'll be here Thursday evening, and she'll be here Thursday evening, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in Crawford to do this action. I just wanted to call in and let you guys know that Daniel Ellsberg is down here in Crawford with us.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, 5:30 a.m. this morning. Daniel Ellsberg, Enright, Ambassador Enright, who was, you might remember, the one of the first ambassadors of the Bush administration who resigned in protest of the Iraq War.
Yes.
And Dee Dee Sheehan, Cindy's sister, set up the original Camp Casey 1, which was set up last August by Cindy, and promptly the McLennan County police came and warned them that they are in violation of recently passed county McLennan County laws, which prohibits camping and assembling in the area of President Bush's ranch.
Where do they have to go? Dallas to assemble or what?
That's right. Yeah, that's the nearest free speech zone. So we will be challenging McLennan County's new laws, and there's about 15-20 people that have volunteered to get arrested. So the sheriff said he'll be back at 8 a.m. Central Standard Time to arrest anybody who has not cleared the area.
Okay, that would be 9 o'clock Eastern, huh?
That is correct.
Yes. Oh, man, incredible. So that's going to come up in another 45 minutes or so. Hattie, have you seen any sign of the president as yet?
We have just heard that he's here. We did hear a helicopter last evening go overhead. So, but the media has confirmed that the president is in town.
Mm-hmm. Now, Hattie, the ordinances, let me get this right and make sure our audience understands this. The ordinances have been changed since Cindy Sheehan was there before. So now they've kind of like, these are kind of like the Sheehan ordinances. Is that it?
That's exactly right. I mean, they passed these laws just after August, after the events of last August, to prohibit, Americans who want to exercise their First Amendment right of freedom of expression to come to this area. It is strictly enforced towards people who do not agree with the president's war policy. So if you agree with the president, you are welcome here. But if you do not agree, don't come over here.
Wow, that's incredible.
That's what they're saying.
So there's going to be 15-20 people who are actually going to volunteer to get arrested later on this morning.
That's right, yeah. And Daniel Ellsberg might be in that group.
All right. Daniel Ellsberg, certainly a peace activist of long standing.
Veteran.
Yeah, veteran peace activist. And please, when you see Cindy, give her our regards. And please, our thoughts are with all of you this morning down in Crawford, Texas.
Thank you very much. And we would like to invite everybody who's in your listening audience to consider coming down to Crawford. We have events planned for the entire week. We have a massive rally on Saturday. We have a dedication of Casey Sheehan Memorial Peace Garden on Friday at the Crawford Peace House.
Okay.
And we will serve a meal on Thanksgiving Day at Camp D2. We have a large tent that can accommodate up to 2,000 people. So y'all come on down to Texas.
All right. Hattie, thank you so much, man.
All right. Thank you, brother.
Take care. All right, that's Hattie. He's calling from the Crawford Peace House. And that, of course, is the place from which Camp Casey was constructed. And now they've got local ordinances that will lock people up if they try and camp out.
You know, Mark, it's amazing how this administration insulates itself from just every little, explosion that could possibly occur.
Yeah, I know. I call it fascism, and I think it's creepy fascism.
Oh, man. It's amazing this man's not impeached yet with what goes on. I had a chance to see that Frontline piece you were talking about last
about
night.
Katrina, sure.
And, you know, when you look back at what happened during the Clinton years and you juxtapose that with what's going on with FEMA now, you know, it's so blatant
that
this administration, you know, could care less, and it's all about them.
Well, yeah, really. And now the FEMA, the reconstruction of New Orleans apparently has been put behind the back burner, mm-hmm. not just on it, behind it. It doesn't look like anybody in the administration seems to have any interest in it anymore. Wayne Gilman, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us.
Sure.
We are going to talk momentarily with Bob Sullivan. He's MSNBC's tech and consumer affairs correspondent, and he's the author of Your Evil Twin, Behind the Identity Theft Epidemic. A lot of stuff going on in the tech world. We'll get to it next. It's 14 minutes past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
This is Cindy Sheehan. Whether I'm waking up in Crawford, Texas, Washington, D.C., or Vacaville, California, I wake up with Mark Maron and Mark Riley. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley, and Mark Maron is off today. He's down in Florida getting ready to feed the multitudes. He will be back with you on Monday. I will be off for the following week and join you the following Monday. And, of course, we'll be doing best of Morning Sedition broadcasts both tomorrow and Friday. If you're just joining us, we want to let you know what's going on in the world before you head out to work. Jose Padilla, the so-called dirty bomber, has been indicted after 3 years in stir, but he wasn't indicted for being a dirty bomber. An American-born Muslim has been convicted for plotting to assassinate President George W. Bush. Abu Ali may face life in prison when he's sentenced in February. Tom DeLay did not get his charges thrown out yesterday. The criminal charges, money laundering, conspiracy, all that stuff. The Judge Pat Priest in Texas would not throw it out. He is going to consider it, and he may even end up dropping the charges, but it's not going to come in time for Tom DeLay to make another run at House Majority Leader. The Pentagon and the Secretary of State are both talking about the possibility of a troop reduction in Iraq. Gee, does President Bush and Vice President Cheney know about that? At any rate, lots to talk about in the world of technology these days. To put it mildly, Sony BMG is not having the best times right now. TiVo is planning to allow its customers to download programs into their iPod videos. How's that going to affect the future of television watching? And in just in case you missed it, the new Xbox 360 was released yesterday. Joining us on the phone from Seattle to break it all down is MSNBC's tech and consumer affairs correspondent, also the author of Your Evil Twin, Behind the Identity Theft Epidemic. Bob Sullivan, good to have you back on the show. How you doing, man?
I'm well, Mark. How are you?
Good, good. Welcome, and thanks so much for getting up at an ungodly hour on the West Coast.
It is 5 in the morning, but I thought about it. You know, my mom got up for years and years to make turkey at about this time on Thanksgiving Day. So in honor of her, here I am.
Oh, thank you very much. And thank your mom for me as well.
Sure, you bet.
Now, what's going on at Sony BMG? Is it as simple to say that instead of just selling people CDs, they were selling people spyware?
Well, of course, nothing's ever that simple, but it's close. Sony was really close to the edge here, and you know what? I think they're paying for it now. When you bought one of these CDs, you put it in your computer at home. In order to listen to it, you had to agree to download a piece of software, which they pretty much told you was just an innocent-looking music player. But underneath that music player, hiding secretly on your computer, was this program that watched to make sure that you were not pirating or even making copies of this CD for your car or another stereo at home.
Now, Bob, let's set out for people. This wasn't all the artists on Sony BMG, but who were some of the more prominent ones that had their CDs encoded like
this? There were 20 CDs over the last year that were encoded with this software, including people like Celine Dion, Neil Diamond. So these are not small acts. These are millions of CDs we're talking about.
Wow. Now, did the artists know that their CDs were encoded? I wonder.
most of the time the artists don't. It's not really part of the contract that they sign with the music folks. And while this suspicious software only involved 20 CDs, Sony actually uses several different versions of this kind of anti-piracy technology, and it involves tens of millions of CDs, so it's very common now.
Now, what was Sony's reaction when people started seeing these problems turn up with their computers after having messed with this stuff?
Well, you tell me if this scenario is familiar. About a month ago, an internet blogger discovers this secret software, puts it up on a website. A bunch of bloggers get really excited about it, and Sony's first reaction is, what are you worried about?
It does sound familiar, Bob.
This is no big deal, and then the story starts to hit major media, and Sony says, what are you worried about? 2 weeks after the fact, Sony is still saying, I don't understand what the problem is, and eventually they get it. And first they say that they'll stop putting this software on new CDs, and then a few days later, when the dust up still doesn't die down, they issue a recall. But nevertheless, Sony is still not out of the water. They were sued this week by the Texas Attorney General's office. Other organizations are looking at suing Sony over this too. It's a big problem.
Now, Bob, are they really that ignorant? When they were saying what's the problem, they didn't know what the problem was?
You know, it was a public relations fiasco, honestly. I think there is an awful lot of corporate arrogance out there, and here's what the central issue of this whole story is. Whose PC is it? Consumers out there are just so sick and tired of having software show up on their computers. It's something you spent $2,000 for. It's in your home, and you got all these pop-ups, you got spyware, you got adware, you got all this spam. And here you have a company like Sony putting software in your computer and not really telling you about it, and that just puts people over the edge.
Now, Bob, we are entering what is generally called the holiday season. Put on your thinking cap or your predictive cap and tell us whether or not this is going to hurt Sony's holiday sales, all this bad pub.
Well, you know, there isn't a lot that stops people from buying music, right?
If they want Celine Dion, damn it, they're going to get Celine Dion.
That's the thing. And most people really don't think about the label when they're in a music store. They think about the artist. So I think it's far-fetched to say that this will really hurt Sony a lot. However, you know, boy, Sony and spyware are now in people's consciousness around the country. And again, I think that they could have done a lot better by saying mea culpa immediately and acting on it very quickly and acting like, you know, we realize that we've done something bad here. Sony still really hasn't come forward and admitted something was wrong.
25 minutes past the hour, we're talking with Bob Sullivan, MSNBC's tech and consumer affairs correspondent. Bob, real quickly, what's going on? TiVo is developing something that would allow customers to download programs onto their iPods. How is that going to work?
This is a really big deal. You might recall about a month ago that Apple released this new video iPod and had a deal with Disney where you could download programs like Desperate Housewives for $1.99 a pop and watch them on your new iPod, which is cool enough, and I think that's a big deal. It's hard to remember 5 years ago when the music industry was in chaos and online downloading, illegal downloading was everywhere. Apple stepped in, launched the iPod, launched iTunes, and suddenly that organized itself, and iTunes is now very successful. I think that the video iPod has the potential to do the same thing, but you know what? Here's TiVo coming along and saying, you don't got to pay $1.99. Everything you record at home, we'll just let you put it on that video iPod, and suddenly the whole television, all of cable, all DirecTV will be able to be viewed for free on your iPod. It's a tremendous change in the way we're going to consume television, I believe.
Now, Bob, can you stay with us for a minute?
You bet.
Great, because there's something I want to ask you, because I heard a story yesterday that not everyone is so thrilled about this TiVo iPod thing, including perhaps one guy by the name of Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah, a lot of those folks won't like this.
Yeah, we're going to find out why they won't like it and find out a little bit about this whole Xbox thing, because, you know, I have, I think, stopped playing video games after Pac-Man, and at this point, I can't see what all the fuss is about. But I do know there is a fuss. So, Bob, thanks a lot for staying with us. Bob Sullivan is MSNBC's tech and consumer affairs correspondent. He's also the author of Your Evil Twin, Behind the Identity Theft Epidemic. And we'll get into that a little bit, too, because, you know, identity theft is, you know, hasn't gone away since the last time we were talking with Bob. And we're going to talk about some top stories. And, of course, before our show is done, we're going to be talking to the Goliath of Gotham, Mark Green. He's going to come in and tell us what holiday politics are going to be going on, because, you know, a lot of people stop paying attention today, and they don't come back until sometime after the new year. Mark will tell you what they expect. Stay with us. This is Morning Sedition. Mark Maron is off. My name is Mark Riley, and this is Air America Radio.
With Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. It's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron has a well-deserved day off, and we're talking with Bob Sullivan, MSNBC's technical and tech and consumer affairs correspondent and author of the book Your Evil Twin: Behind the Identity Theft Epidemic. Mark, just before the break, we were Mark, what am I thinking about?
You miss your partner, that's right.
Yeah, I miss Maron. What can I tell you? We were talking about this whole TiVo iPod situation and whether or not someone like Rupert Murdoch, who I understand owns a little piece of DirecTV, might be trying to stand in the way of all this.
Well, if you sell television programming for a living, would you be happy about somebody else giving it away? And there's this other element to all of this that's really a fundamental...
I don't know, though. You know, when you pose it that way, it's kind of like, do hookers get upset about wives? I don't know.
Well, I never thought about it that way.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
But here's the thing. Of course, you know, Rupert would rather get his $1.99 for programs rather than TiVo giving them away for free. I think
sure.
That's the issue. Television producers, makers of the content, are hoping that this is a new revenue channel, not just a new convenience for consumers.
Mm. Now, what can they do to stop it, if anything?
There's been a lot of successful stopping, if you will, of online file sharing, and there are some, none of these parallels are going to be very neat, of course, we're in a brave new world, but, Apple is doing okay by charging for people's ability to download music, whereas Grokster and Napster and so on weren't okay because they were giving it away for free. And I think that's, you know, about what we're talking about here, with the exception, obviously, that TiVo has already acquired a right to collect these programs in people's houses. And the concept at play here is something called time shifting and location shifting, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Time shifting has already been declared legal by U.S. courts years ago with the VCR, right? So you can tape programs and watch them after they air anytime you want.
Sure.
That's pretty clear. But as far as taking them and moving them around, that's not nearly as clear. So you can tape a program in your house and watch it later in your house, but can you tape it in your house and then watch it later on the bus or something like that? Obviously, again, very convenient for consumers, but for people who make content, they want to make more money out of that.
So in other words, they want some kind of per-use fee? Is that what you're saying?
They want some kind of fee, whether it's per use or per copy or whatever.
All right, but let's say for the sake of argument they actually got that. What would stop someone? What would stop, for example, Chris Lopresto, who works with our board here at Air America, who's a real tech-savvy guy? What's stopping him from making one copy and passing it around?
Well, you know, absolutely nothing. And the resulting mess of this conversation is what we just talked about with Sony. You know, companies that try to put a lid on technology and, frankly, put a lid on consumer behavior, they often run up against brick walls.
You know, it's interesting because Apple seems to not have actually put up a wall against consumer behavior. How have they managed to make the iTunes thing thrive while other people are seemingly trying to put up these walls, as you point out?
I think that everybody better take a really good look at the history of online music again, because, you know, all Apple did was they gave people a fair and easy way to do this, and they organized things. But more than anything, and forgive me for being a bit Pollyannish here, but there was a lot of online music stealing going on when there was no other way to get online music. But once it was legal and it was a fair price, most people now are okay with paying 99 cents for a song.
Yeah.
They didn't like paying $20 for albums with only one song on them that they liked.
Now, Bob, I got to ask you this. Did you hear rumors that there were record companies that were actually sending viruses through some of the illegal online file sharing?
Not rumors. That's true.
That is true.
Yeah, yeah. There were companies doing all sorts of things in an attempt to dissuade folks from using those services.
Incredible. Now let's talk about something else that's a little incredible. This Xbox thing, because I have no idea what an I wouldn't know an Xbox if one fell on my head. What's all the hype?
Well, what's all the hype? You know, I think you and I are in the same boat here, and I wish people would go out and join Little League baseball teams and whatnot.
Yes.
Instead of sitting in their houses. You know, last year was the first year that the game industry, the video game industry, made more money than Hollywood. So we are as a society, we are getting more and more likely to be stuck in our homes all day and all night doing things just with our families rather than out in the world doing things together in groups, and that concerns me. The big deal about the Xbox is the graphics are incredible. You can feel like you're watching an NFL football game, only you're playing it instead of just watching it, and it's that powerful. And the Xbox has all sorts of other capabilities. It lets you play games across the internet with other people. It lets you store games that you're in the middle of, and it's also this hub, if you will. This is Microsoft's goal here, to make it the hub of your home entertainment programming, so you can watch DVDs on it and eventually use it to listen to music around your house and all that kind of thing.
It must be a big deal, because Bill Gates, apparently, who people never, ever see, apparently went to a Best Buy store, I think, near his house or something to start hyping.
In Washington, not far from where I am, he was actually helping cashiers ring up sales the night that the Xbox came out.
Oh, man, you know, if it was me, the urge to just snatch the cash out of the guy's hand would have been too much, I'll tell you that. Is it a good piece of technology, Bob?
Well, it's a really impressive piece of technology, and I think what we're going to see is this movement towards one additional box that's a PC that is just another stereo. Well, just another. It's sort of, if you will, at the head of the table of all your stereo components in your house, and maybe that'll make things ultimately easier for consumers. But boy, I sure hope kids don't stop playing basketball.
Yeah, me neither. I want to jump back to digital music for a second, because there's a story that's saying that the iPod's online music store has now beaten out three traditional standalone music retailers during the July through September time frame. Now, that may not seem like a big deal to most folks, but when you consider that the iTunes music store beat out Tower Records, Sam Goody, and Borders, it would seem as though we're starting to see a little paradigm shift here in how people buy their music, no?
Well, there's a big shift here. I don't go to music stores anymore, and I'm a bit of a skeptic, as you just heard, for all this technology. But, again, just to make this point, record companies have for years gotten away with putting one or two good songs on CDs and loading them up with, crap, and then asking us to pay $17.99 for them when all you really wanted was one or two songs. And now I go to iTunes and I buy them for a buck a piece, and that's fair to me.
But now, isn't that on some level the record companies undercutting their own business? I mean, it theoretically, it doesn't cost as much to put, for example, 10 tunes you like, to download 10 tunes you like, as it would be to buy an album, right?
Yeah, it's still, in a lot of cases, the prices are comparable now. The prices of CDs in stores have actually flattened out a bit thanks to all this competition. But the record companies, I guess they are undercutting themselves, but they didn't have a choice thanks to Napster and Grokster, who really forced the hand here.
Yeah, I'll tell you, if you ever come to New York, I will take you to a record store, or a music store, I should say, that will restore your faith in music stores. There's a place here in New York called Academy Music, which is the most incredible place. It is a place that you really have to go just to experience, because you have all these people that actually talk music. You know, most music stores, you go in and the clerk can't even tell you what genre something is.
Right.
Well, this is a place where you go in and people, musicians actually come in and start talking about, their travels and that sort of thing. It's a whole different experience, and I hope we never lose that.
Well, me too, and sign me up for that, by the way. I'll be in New York next month, so let's go.
Really? Yeah, absolutely. Bob Sullivan, as always, a real joy to talk with you. Made it plain for all of us, especially, a technically ignorant geek such as myself.
All right, happy Thanksgiving to everybody.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, man, and take care and say hi to your mom for me.
I will. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. Bob Sullivan, joining us from Seattle, Washington. Man, that's an incredible time frame in the morning, that's for sure. And, of course, we have got coming up shortly the Goliath of why am I so tongue-tied with the term Goliath of Gotham? Maybe Dave has made me a little nervous about this, because he's the Goliath of Air America Radio. But the Goliath of Gotham is up next. Mark Green joins us when we wrap and tie Morning Sedition. It's Air America Radio, 43 minutes past the hour.
Hi, this is Phil Lesh from the Grateful Dead. One time, I was listening to Morning Sedition and Marin started riffing on the Bush administration. Then Riley came in with a slamming groove about the right wing's use of the media. Just when you thought it couldn't get any freakier, Marin broke into Scarlet Begonias. What a sick jam. Best show ever. Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
With Mark Maron and Mark Riley, in conjunction with Air America Radio Productions, is pleased to present the following guest. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls of all ages, fasten your seatbelts and prepare yourselves to be rocked, rocked, rocked. Now entering the studio is the man who joins us each and every Wednesday. 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 He's president of the New Democracy Project and the co-author of the book on Bush. In 2001, he was the Democratic nominee for New York City mayor. Make some noise for the monster of Midtown, the Goliath of Gotham, Mark Guerin.
28 minutes past the hour. That's right. It was the monster of Midtown. That's the one I couldn't remember. I remember the Goliath of Gotham.
Everybody else remembers, Mark. I don't know how you could forget.
I'm getting old. What can I tell you? Good morning, Mark Green. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Now, before we get into some meaty issues of the day, we do want to play for our audience Ted Koppel's sign-off. Ted Koppel, of course, concluded his tenure as host of Nightline last night after 25 years. March 1980 was when he first started, when the Iran hostage crisis was on the front burner of everyone's minds. And this is what he had to say last night on his final broadcast.
There's this quiz I give to some of our young interns when they first arrive at Nightline. I didn't do it with the last batch. It's a little too close to home. How many of you, I'll ask, can tell me anything about Eric Severide? Blank stares. How about Howard K. Smith or Frank Reynolds? Not a twitch of recognition. Chet Huntley? Jack Chancellor? Still nothing. David Brinkley sometimes causes a hand or two to be raised, and Walter Cronkite may be glad to learn that a lot of young people still have a vague recollection that he once worked in television news. What none of these young men and women in their late teens and early 20s appreciates, until I point it out to them, is that they have just heard the names of seven anchormen or commentators who were once so famous that everyone in the country knew their names. Everybody. Trust me, the transition from one anchor to another is not that big a deal. Cronkite begat Rather, Chancellor begat Brokaw, Reynolds begat Jennings. And each of them did a pretty fair job in his own right. You've always been very nice to me, so give this new anchor team for Nightline a fair break. If you don't, I promise you the network will just put another comedy show in this time slot. And then you'll be sorry. That's our report for tonight. I'm Ted Koppel in Washington. For all of us here at ABC News, good night.
Kind of a nice denouement, wouldn't you say, Mark Green?
I saw it last night with my wife, and we both said, almost simultaneously, so classy.
Yes.
So literate. And so right. Mark, when I was the New York City public advocate, I would often go to schools. And when I would go to all black fifth and sixth grades, I would ask kids, do you know who Michael Jackson is? 100%.
Sure.
Do you know who David Dinkins is? He was the first black mayor from 89 to 93. Hardly a blink. It was the same experience that Koppel had when he mentioned Severide and Chancellor. In other words, Mark Riley, do what you do well right now, because in 10 years...
Oh, I know.
It's not even Mark.
I've been around for a long time. I know what's going
to
happen. Absolutely.
To all of us.
Mark, let's talk about some politics here. Let's talk, first of all, about a man I know you know a bit about, Dick Cheney, who apparently has been the attack dog du jour for the Bush administration and lashing out at people who have talked about withdrawing troops from Iraq. Was that a bad move on the part of the Bush administration to make him the spokesperson?
It's their last-ditch effort. And once Republicans in the Senate had a resolution saying, let's start looking toward a withdrawal date, once the Iraqi authorities 2 days ago said, let's start looking for a withdrawal day because we don't like to be occupied. As John Kenneth Galbraith once said of the Great Depression, the end had come, but it was not yet in sight. The end is coming. They had nothing else to do but try to, since they don't have the truth on their side, and the reality on the ground is so awful and getting worse, they just trotted out this attack. Now, Cheney, if the press had guts and took a truth serum, they would have to always write, Vice President Dick Cheney, comma, a known serial liar, comma, today said, you know, nothing he has told us has been true. I have no idea why any journalist, much less any citizen, would believe anything he says. Mark, remember how Muhammad Atta met in Prague with Saddam officials?
Oh, yeah, I remember that fiction.
But then it was proven to be untrue, and then he denied ever saying it.
Yeah.
And then John Stewart showed clips back-to-back showing that he was not only wrong, that could happen, but lying. Remember when he debated John Edwards and said, you know, I've never met you before tonight, and I presided over the Senate. And then, of course, there were clips showing them routinely meeting. Remember when he said, not only did they know where WMD was, that it was that it could be airborne and reach the United States. These guys are chicken littles. The public, a little too late, but finally has caught up with them. And if this doesn't work to bump Bush's numbers up, and I don't see it doing it, we have a phenomenal thing here. We have 3 years of a crippled president.
But now, do we see coming out, because we hear the Pentagon talking about standing down three brigades, which is over 10,000 people out of Iraq. Are we seeing the Bush administration toss a bone to congressional Republicans who are scared to death that this is going to come back to bite them November next year?
I assume so. I remember about a year ago, I was at a dinner with Senator Hillary Clinton, who knows much more about this than I do. And I said, isn't Bush, approaching the 06 midterms, given how bad things are going in Iraq, going to start pulling down troops just to, because he's a politician even more than he's an ideologue. He said, no, these people really mean it. Well, a year later, it's gotten so bad that I think it's inevitable, given that Republican reelect numbers in the House and Senate are worse than Democrat reelect numbers were in the House and Senate in 1993. In 1994, when, of course, the Republicans took over. My guess is they'll pull down some, and he'll do what Nixon did, which is say Vietnam is crucial, we'll never leave, we've got to stop the communists, on the one hand. With the other hand, he was withdrawing. Mm. So he'll feed his base rhetoric, he'll feed the rest of the country, that is the realists' policy, and I assume we won't be out of there entirely in a year, but at this rate, starting with Cindy Sheehan and through John Murtha and now the rest of the country, it could be substantial withdrawals by then.
You know, it's interesting you drew that line, Cindy Sheehan and John Murtha. But in the minute or so we have left, there are some people who are already handicapping the 08 Republican presidential nomination race. And they're talking about Condoleezza Rice, who says she doesn't want it. John McCain, who may or may not run. And someone we're both very familiar with from our time here in New York, Rudy Giuliani, the former mayor. Has he got any shot, Mark Green?
Yes.
He does?
Yes, and remember, I'm not his best friend. I'm
what
not going to be.
What voted. Are you saying here?
People around the country may not know. I was the ranking Democrat in New York City for the 8 years he was the ranking Republican as mayor. I was next in line called public advocate. I used to joke I was a heartbeat away from Giuliani, assuming he had one.
Ooh.
This is a very tough guy. Of Giuliani, it could be said either you love him or he hates you.
Yeah.
The reality, though, is he's very tough. Very smart, very focused. In high school, wrote the Daily News in a profile, he used to stand in front of a mirror with his girlfriend there, raise his hand and go, I, Rudolph Wilson Giuliani.
Wow.
He was solid, and he was mimicking his presidential inaugural address.
Wait a minute, is that focus or obsession?
Both.
Both? Now what about a McCain-Giuliani ticket? Would that fly? Would that dog hunt?
Yes.
It would.
Since they don't listen to Air America, let me say it worries me. When you have a Southern Rim, acceptable conservative like McCain, who is really resonating around the country now on his torture stuff, and he's a consistent, principled man who's extremely conservative, with an urban Northeast Catholic who's gotten votes.
A pro-choice Catholic.
Now, the issue is Giuliani, who cross-dressed in a comedy sketch in New York a couple of times.
Oh, no.
It didn't bother me.
Didn't bother me either. I'd love to see him in a dress.
But there are some Bible Belters who were maybe offended by it. Giuliani will probably in the next year or two switch on a couple of like late-term abortion issues to be a little more acceptable. It's unlikely, but he could be on a ticket, and the ticket could win.
Mark Green, thank you so much for being with us. As always, it's a pleasure having you here, and happy Thanksgiving to you,
you
and
too.
Yours. Happy Thanksgiving to all of us who've been listening this morning. It's been my pleasure. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.